Welcome to the AZ Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Hamid Chojai, a tech enthusiast and entrepreneur. Recently, my wife and I sold our software companies and we're investing $10 million in Arizona's tech ecosystem. As a way to know what's happening in Arizona, every week I get to sit down with some exceptionally talented people who are doing some cool shit. All right, let's go. All right, I'm here with Jamie Baxter, CEO and co-founder of Quick, one of Arizona's fastest growing startups, which almost died because of COVID, right? Hey, Jamie, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Let's jump right into Quick. There's so much story around Quick that I want to talk about. First, give us a quick background about what Quick is, and then I'll start asking questions because I know a lot of the sort of things that have happened over the past year. And I want to talk a lot about COVID and how that affected the company. And I know you guys have come back. So do a quick rundown of what Quick is and when you guys got started, and then we'll jump into the Q&A.
The quick background on Quick.
The quick background. And by the way, it's Quick. So
yeah, exactly.
If anybody is listening, it's .com. But
let's see. I'll kind of tell the origination story. The idea for Quick actually came from my co-founder, Chris. Chris is, he owns a company called Caliber actually here in Phoenix, and they own a bunch of hotels, and his number one problem of running these hotels is staffing.
Right.
So he always ran into issues on a daily basis of people calling out sick. You have a big event, you need more people. Seasonality changes a bunch of needs. So, and a very high turnover as well, right? Like over 100% turnover. So he had this idea for ordering staff just like you order an Uber. You know, you push a button, magic happens, people show up to work. And I had left my job in corporate America and was doing somewhat of a little mini retirement and got bored and was looking for something else to do. And I was like, that is a fantastic idea.
Right.
And it fit really well into my wheelhouse. I had done a bunch of stuff in all HR technology related products in the past. So
there was a period of time where you had to describe your startup. Everyone had to describe their startup in terms of Uber. Like you had to describe, like if you could describe it as Uber 4X, you were going to get funding. If you couldn't describe it as that, is that about the time frame when you guys started? You're like, we're Uber for staffing. And then people are just throwing money at you or?
I wish it was that easy.
Okay.
I never liked to use the word Uber because I felt like it was overplayed.
Okay. Because everyone was describing
everyone. It's the Uber for X, right?
Yeah. Uber for water.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we need that? Faucet is already there.
Exactly. It's kind of already on demand.
Yeah.
We typically like to say it's like the gig economy for food and beverage, an on-demand marketplace, a labor marketplace. But yeah, it's the Uber for staffing food and beverage is, easy way to say it. And it's, if I'm describing it to my mom, that's how I would describe it. It's like, it's like how Uber works, and it's just for staffing restaurants.
You push a button and a bunch of people show up to work for you.
Exactly.
That's amazing. I mean, like that the concept is super simple in that way. And it seems like no brainer that, of course this is a problem. So what year was this when you guys were starting?
We founded the company at the end of 2017 and launched in early 2018.
And had anything like this been tried yet? Or like were you guys the first to be Uber for staffing?
It had been done.
Okay.
Been done in different categories, so different types of staffing. And it had been done in food and beverage. When we started, the biggest player was a company called ShiftGig. They were doing about $60 million in revenue when we started.
So what made you guys think that, like, despite the heavy competition, that this was a good idea then for you guys to be yet another?
I thought we could do it better. I did a lot of looking at the competitive landscape, and I didn't think anyone was doing it great. I also thought we could take a different approach to it with Chris and the hotels he owned. And I ended up investing in his company as well. So through that, we're owners in Marriott and Hilton and IHG properties. So it gave us an inside track, and I thought we could use that to our advantage. I always like to have an unfair advantage in any new business I go into.
Yeah.
And if we approached it more as a hospitality business selling to other hospitality businesses, I thought that would be a much better play than trying to take a, well, we're a tech heavy business and trying to shove technology down your throats.
Right.
But overall, I just thought that a lot of players were doing this and they were basically just reinventing the job board, but doing it more on demand. So a business would post a shift and all of a sudden it appears on everyone's app and someone can pick it up. But our idea was actually to create an algorithm that would actually evaluate who the best professionals were,
okay,
and offer those professionals, the best professionals, more shifts. So instead of just kind of blasting it out to everyone, we would actually use this algorithm to drive how to send out the invites and do more prescribed matching and come up with a better situation for both the professionals and the business partners. So I thought there was a lot of room for improvement. And
So
timing was good, right? Like,
right.
It's not always about who's first, but like, when is the timing right? And everyone, I felt like the timing was right for people to really accept a solution when we started it.
Okay. But with, if some company in, you mentioned one of them, was it Quick Shifts?
Well, not Shift Gig.
Shift Gig. I'm sorry. I'm combining your name with Shift Gig. But if Shift Gig was already doing 60 million, like what was, like when you looked at Shift Gig, what was the obvious thing that they were missing that you're like, we can do some aspect of this better? Was it the matching? Because how did you know like how they're matching people anyway? Or did you use them for a while? Or
Yeah, we had one of the hotels use them.
Okay.
We found out who some of their customers were and talked to their customers. They weren't delivering quality. They didn't have great customer service. So they weren't taking care of their businesses or their professionals well. They were charging a lot more than I thought they needed to as well. I thought we could do it cheaper. But you can learn a lot from downloading all your competitors' apps and just kind of going through them and like seeing what how it works.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So at some point you're like, okay, we can do a better job of this. Maybe the algorithm is the secret sauce of like matching. Then what happened?
So I moved out here to Phoenix from San Diego to start Quick.
Why here? Why not San Diego?
I was attracted to what I saw was more of an emerging tech scene here.
Really? That's awesome. As an Arizona like enthusiast and, you know, like fan, I'm like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
but like what, San Diego is also very similar to Phoenix. Why like not San Diego?
Well, as far as the ecosystem goes, like San Diego has a lot of pharma and biotech, right? But not as much like SaaS or just general, you know, no marketplace technology companies or things that were there.
Okay.
I was also attracted to the legislative landscape of Arizona, and starting a new business in Arizona is, I think, a lot better than starting a new business in California.
In California.
And then going back to that unfair advantage, most of Chris's hotels that he owns are here in Phoenix.
Right.
So one of the first things that we did when we got here was let's sit down and like talk to his management teams that are running these hotels and talk about the problems they're having and talk about how, you know, they were using traditional staffing agencies to help augment their staff. And so what worked well, what didn't work well, and let's figure out exactly the problem we're solving and get some real inside information to figure it out.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then like, at what point did you decide, okay, we're on to something, let's go raise some money around this and, you know, like hit the road with the idea?
Well, I knew we were on to something when I could tell that every conversation I had with someone that was, you know, the director of food and beverage talked about how painful this was and how there wasn't a great solution out there for it. And when I shared the idea in just a very crude mock-up of what I was thinking,
they were super excited.
They were just like so excited.
Yeah.
So I put the initial capital in to get us started. And we developed an MVP. We actually went through Coplex as an accelerator to get our MVP up and test it out. And it was a stupid simple, just kind of interface. We allowed a professional to sign up. They could tell us about when they were available to work and what type of experience they had. And we'd allow a business to sign up and go through a very simple one-page form that says, all right, what type of person do you need? When do you need them? How much do you want to pay? And that was it. It was a complete facade. There was no technology behind it.
Okay.
Every time a business would sign up, it would email me and say, hey, the Hilton Phoenix Airport needs a bartender tonight at 6 p.m. And
you were the algorithm.
We,
you're like, oh.
We were using Google Voice and using the text messaging on Google Voice to start texting people and say, Hamid, are you available to work tonight at 6 p.m. at the Hilton Phoenix Airport for $23 an hour? Reply yes or no. And we would send that message out. And if someone said yes, then we were like, okay, mark that person down. They can work. And
that is awesome.
Then we'd say, all right, it's time for your shift. And so we'd have to wait till 6 p.m. and we'd text them, all right, text clock in when you arrive and you're on site. And they would text us the word clock in. And
you were doing all this stuff manually.
Yeah.
This totally reminds me of the Zappos story where the guy was being told that you can't sell shoes on the internet. Do you know that this story?
Yeah.
So he goes and takes pictures at the Nordstrom shoe store.
Exactly.
And puts up the shoes, and then every sale that he has to run to Nordstrom to buy a pair of shoes.
And then ship them out.
And then ship them out at his cost, essentially, because he did free shipping. So, but it proved out the idea.
Exactly.
And this is what a lot of people who are trying to build a company forget, is that you don't need to make money on your first few hundred thousand, possibly tens of thousands of users or customers, but it's about scaling it later, proving out the idea initially for fairly little cost manually is way cheaper than if you tried to build software for all of that stuff. It would have cost you millions.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you don't know what you don't know, right?
Right.
And so what I always tell my team is when we want to do something new, I want to experience it in that manual fashion. And I want to experience it tens, if not hundreds of times, but I want to see at least 10 different variations.
Right.
Like,
because we could do it differently too.
Exactly.
Manually.
And what are the different curveballs that people are going to send you? Like, you can't do it just knowing what one customer wants. You got to get 10 customers that are doing it. And, oh, what about when this happens? What about that? You know, when this happens, what happens when someone doesn't show up? How do you deal with that? And so once you've proven that out and you've felt the pain and it's now so painful that you can't do it manually anymore.
That's when you automate it.
That's when you automate it. And then you just automate that piece.
Yeah.
And then wait till the next piece. But there's no way what we did was scalable. And there was no way we were ever going to make money. We were losing money.
Right.
You know, but what we're trying to do is just prove that someone would trade us a dollar for what we wanted to sell.
Yeah.
And
now what's interesting about the kind of marketplace that Quick is, or the type of business that Quick is that you need two sides of the marketplace. You need both the sort of staff to be there and you need the businesses to be there. So, you know, whenever, again, I hear pitches like this, this is the catch-22 problem. Without the user base, you won't get the businesses. Without the businesses, you won't get the user base. So how did you guys solve that problem?
Yeah, it's the chicken or egg, right?
Right.
We've always built up the supply first. So we think of our supply as our professionals.
Okay.
And then demand as our business partners, the hotels and catering companies. And the reason is that we knew that it was going to be an uneven marketplace. So it's two-sided, but we knew that there would be a whole lot more professionals and a lot less business partners.
Right.
So while we don't want to lose a professional, right, we care a lot about our professionals, losing a business partner was detrimental to us in a huge way. Even today, we have 100,000 professionals, but 2,000 business partners.
Right.
So when we have a business partner that wants to use us, we want to make sure we're successful. And our business partners, you know, we're B2C on the professional side. We're B2B on the other side of marketplace. So it's not only just the two-sided, but it's B2C and B2B.
Right.
When you lose a business, it's a lot harder to make that reputation back up. When it's B2C, you can always go get another consumer. But if we upset Marriott, that's a huge reputational risk for us.
Right.
So we want to make sure we always have the supply. And we actually took the step of actually pre-vetting and certifying the supply, meeting with every single person in person before they could take shifts, because we cared so much about ensuring that we were doing the right thing for those business partners. So we built up the supply, and we would hold these orientation sessions and tell them about Quick. But we'd tell them, hey, listen, we're a brand new company. You're one of our founding professionals. Be patient with us. It's awesome. You're on the ground floor, and this is going to be an amazing thing. We're going to look back on this and all remember, remember those days when you were a professional on our platform and there was no shifts available? they will come. Just right. be patient with us. And the great thing about what we built was, unlike an Uber driver that you have to get on, they've got to have the app open, be ready to drive somebody. Our people can just be sitting at home or working another job.
They get a text
job.
Message.
They just get a text message, and it's like, no, I don't want to work that shift.
Right.
But we don't have to have them actively engaged, so they can be kind of a dormant supply until you need to activate them, and then they go and work.
Wow. That's super interesting. So then it started working.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting businesses who are like, hey, I need some people at such and such time, and then you're filling these shifts. Like, then what happened? Like, this is, like, now you're getting the idea proven, but, like, was that super exciting? Were you guys like, yeah? Was there sort of a high five moment with first sort of like?
I remember, like, we were on shift 100, right? 100 shifts and then 200 shifts. And there were
how long did it take to get 100 shifts filled?
Well, the part of the story that I missed telling was when we first launched, we launched as a housekeeping company.
Okay.
All the hotels we talked to said, we need the most staff in housekeeping.
Housekeeping, interesting.
Over 5 weeks, we learned that we weren't going to be successful. And so we...
What was the reason for that? Is it because housekeepers had to have... Like, what was about the housekeepers in particular that was not successful?
Turns out a lot of housekeepers aren't using apps to find work.
Mm.
They're still going and applying in person. Housekeepers are also often not have the same transportation available. So okay. going and working different places all around town was difficult. But on the business side, I never knew this before, but there's a lot of brand standards that, go into housekeeping. A Marriott housekeeper is different than a Hilton housekeeper.
Hmm.
And they care a lot about, even the placement of their toiletries and how that works for this particular hotel.
So too much training would be necessary to get them to actually be an effective housekeeper.
Yeah.
So that doesn't work for like Friday at, had somebody not come in, I need that shift filled.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then there's uniform requirements, even down to they want the name tag
gotcha.
That says their name on it. So we ran into about 15 different issues, honestly. And
okay.
we thought some were, that we could overcome them. And some we thought, this just may not be the right fit. So we looked at food and beverage, which was the second biggest use case we heard from hotels. And at first, we weren't really excited about it because now you're limited the number of hotels you can sell to, right? Only hotels that have food and beverage, not your limited service that don't.
Right.
Everyone has housekeepers. But we thought, well, we could also open this up to catering companies or to event venues that have this. We wanted to stay with big enterprise clients, but... We also like that the fact that food and beverage professionals were a little higher on the income scale, more adept at using technology, had a better access to transportation, and it was night and day. We saw just tremendous response. Like the first orientation we had for housekeepers, we had 3 housekeepers show up. The first one we did for food and beverage, we had 40 show up.
Oh, wow.
So we went through that pivot. So we started in March. We pivoted over in May of 2018 and then started getting some activity. And then it was my first summer in Phoenix. And it turns
okay.
out things slow down a lot from a hospitality industry in Phoenix
and
during
you're
summer.
Like, this is painful.
And we went with 0 shifts,
oh,
zero
wow.
revenue for all of June. Got a little back in July. August started to get pretty exciting. And then we couldn't keep up with it. And so then we started building technology. We actually built the part of the database that tracked that we had shifts and started actually doing some more automated text messages.
Okay.
And then it was just, 5,000 in revenue 1 month and 10,000 and 80,000.
What made you stick with it when you had 0 shifts filling like in June or July? Like what made you think we're still onto something rather than thinking maybe the time for this is not now?
The thought went through my head of
so like just canning it.
Yeah, it's like, is this going to work? And I had a conversation with Chris, and he's like, "Well, it's just Phoenix. It's just seasonality."
But 0. I mean, like 0 just seems like way more than like that's bad.
Right? It was.
Like you would think you lose 60% of your business or whatever. Like, but wow, that's
yeah. It was really bad. It was scary.
So, I'm kind of foreshadowing here, but did that summer of 2018 prepare you for a little bit for what happened with COVID? Like, would you connect those two? Like, the fact that you lasted through that dip allowed you to, like, be more resilient to last through what happened with you guys in COVID? And I want to come back to COVID later, but this is just a quick, like, do you feel like, did you ever make a connection between those two?
I've never connected it like that. I think at that time I just thought we hadn't had enough traction. Because, you know, we'd only started in...
But there's a certain level of stubbornness that is required for you to just, you know, get a little bit of traction, then lose it all, go down to zero shifts for a couple of months, and then, like, for you to not give up, right? Like, there's a stubbornness that comes with, you know, sticking through that valley of the valley of death, as they call it, right? Yeah.
Well, I you know... Can meet you and I probably share this gene of there's got to be something kind of wrong with us to actually think we can start a company and like make it successful. Most people don't like even take that step, have the courage to do that. And there's got to be something wrong with you in some way to think that you that this is actually going to be okay.
Right.
That's why we do it.
That's awesome. Okay, so keep going. And then, so far you've funded it yourself. You're now getting traction. You're starting to automate stuff. This is September, October timeframe of 2018. At what point do you go out raising money?
So I faced another, we're starting to ramp up and get some traction. We'd gotten to 5,000 in revenue. And I put a $250,000 in to get us started. So I was getting down to the last of that money. And I said, all right, I'll put $250,000 in. I'll give it a year of my time. And if I can't make it, my goal was to get to $1 million run rate in the first year. And so we were coming up on a year from when I founded it, back at the end of 2017. And I was like, oh man, I don't think we're going to get there. Had another talk with Chris and said, hey, I don't know, like maybe I just try something else. You know, go and do something different. He's like, no, man, you're on the cusp. You just give it a little more time. Let's go raise some money. Let's really get this done. And so we decided to, we're at 5,000 in revenue a month, and decided to put together a seed round. And as we're raising that round, the next month we hit 10,000. The next month we hit 80,000.
Wow.
And the round filled up immediately. Got way oversubscribed. And so we ended up raising... Went out to raise $1 million. We ended up getting 2.4 in commitments.
Wow.
And took 1.3 in that round. And then we had some angel, mostly angels, some institutional, and then one of the institutional investors that really wanted in that round, and we were just oversubscribed at that point, kept hounding us. And then 6 months later, we did a proper round and raised 3.5.
Okay. Well, at a better valuation, I presume. And
almost 4x the valuation.
That's awesome. In 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. So now we're 2019. You're doing incredible. The growth is there. You're expanding to other cities. Things are going really good. I mean, feel free to jump in at any point. I don't want to skip over a bunch of stuff before we get to 2020 and COVID. But like...
Yeah. 2018, we got kind of things working here in Phoenix. 2019, we opened up 6 more cities. Ended up doing 550% year-over-year growth. Things, you know, were going really well. We're at the end of 2019 and knew that we're going to need to raise again soon, as we were just rapidly expanding and deploying a lot of capital to get those new cities opened. And we made the decision at the end of 2019 to push our fundraise to the spring of 2020. We said, listen, like, we've got the runway to get there. Let's go out and make as much progress as possible. And we also knew that hospitality has a lot of seasonality, and seasonality is good in the fall, but it's even better in the spring. And so we thought we can make some more progress, get a few more cities open, and take advantage of that revenue ramp of seasonality just driving numbers to the roof. And so we're like, all right, we'll launch our fundraise in February of 2020. Let's do that. And that's when we headed.
And February itself was not a bad month, right? Like nothing had happened yet. There was just discussion of like COVID, and then COVID happened in March.
Yeah, February was an incredible month for us. where we kicked off our fundraise. We're on.
And you're getting a ton of interest, I presume, because the numbers are like astronomical.
Yep.
What was February, just to put things in perspective? Like, how much revenue did you have in February?
$600,000.
$600,000 in 1 month of revenue. And then you're in the middle of fundraising. People are excited. And then shutdowns happen.
Yeah. We get to investment committee with four different VCs. And then the revenue falls off a cliff. It drops 80% overnight. Just
wow.
Boom. Just done. All of our business partners, you know, practically shut down overnight.
Right.
And no one wanted to touch us. From an investment perspective, looked like a very risky business in hospitality, right?
And, yeah.
And no one wants to invest when your revenue drops 80%.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of VCs stopped writing new checks. They focused on their portfolios for a month or two. Ended up turning out to be a very active season for VC, you know, after that initial kind of figuring out period, but still not a great place for us because our revenue was really down. Some people got a lot of benefit from COVID. We were one that really suffered from COVID. So
right.
All of this while we're running out of cash because we pushed that raise out closer to the end of our runway. And so we knew we had to make some pretty big changes really fast. So we came up with two layoff plans. One was a plan V for a V-shaped recovery, and one was a plan L for an L-shaped recovery. And
What is an L-shaped recovery? So V is like where you bounce back quickly.
Yeah, you bounce back.
What's an L?
L, you go down and you just
Stay down, which is what happened basically because of COVID. Okay.
We ended up doing V very quickly. Like mid-March.
Okay.
Plan B was, you know, a smaller amount of staff that we laid off. I guess it was about 10% of staff that we laid off in that round. And then when the last VC that we were talking to pulled out, that was kind of our last hope. Then we did plan L. And
that had to have been tough.
Yeah, I'm getting choked up thinking about
it. Yeah, I mean, I can tell visually. I mean, like, people's livelihoods are affected. And I know as a founder, like, I've gone through that, you know, once distant past. And it is just, like, one of the most gut-wrenching things that you have to do as a founder is to let people go.
Yeah. And we let 60% of the people go on that day.
Wow.
So we were down 70%. From a staff perspective, went from 54 people down to 19. And that's not a question of like who you let go. You know, we wiped the slate clean and said, all right, who do we absolutely have to keep in order to keep the company running? So we had to let everyone go. And then we knew at 19 people, we still didn't have the money to survive what we thought we needed to survive. So the 19 people that we asked to stay, we also asked them to take a really severe pay cut.
Wow.
And we actually end up coming up with a, we call it a salary for equity program, to where we actually gave them equity in a dollar for dollar exchange based upon the last round price so that they earned equity instead of the cash, but allowed us to extend that runway. So asked them to make a, you know, to stay with the company in uncertain times, take a huge pay cut.
But now they became owners in the company, which is what a brilliant way to execute on that.
Yeah. I mean, because we gave.
I mean, you got dealt a shitty hand. There was nothing you could do about it. But like how you handled it, that's pretty incredible. So like how long did that last? Like did were you now thinking that, holy cow, like weeks were turning into months and you might actually have to shut down or.
Well, simultaneously we went out and tried to convince our existing investors to give us some more money. So I went out to each investor and said, I need you to put it in, whatever you put in, I need you to take 25% and put it back into the company again. To give us some runway to get through 2020. So we ended up raising a couple million more dollars through that.
So investors did come through for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like good on them, right? Like how did they see it? Did they see it as like, okay, this is short term, we just need to get through it, or?
Yeah. I think they saw like the incredible growth and like just how much needed it was, and that need would return. They loved the team that we had built, and they like, there's something here. We got to see it through.
Right.
They believed in us. And so most of it was existing investors. We actually did bring in one new VC who we ended up not doing a deal with in our first institutional round. But I'd always liked the partner. We just had stayed in touch, and he took a bet on us. So we ended up raising the money, and it was actually an up round. It was very slight up round, but it was an up round, not a down round. We got through the summer, and Q3, we started to actually see some buildup. We were doing more COVID-related revenue. We're working with a hospital system in New York that couldn't feed all the patients, and so we were actually providing staff to feed those patients. We were working with the Marines in San Diego to help feed the Marines that had to be quarantined before they went to boot camp. So, like, all these weird scenarios came up to where we could find ways to utilize our platform to help them.
They were revenue opportunities, or mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah. And I mean, even at the very beginning of COVID, we saw that the grocery stores couldn't keep like their shelves stocked with toilet paper, right?
Right.
And so all of our professionals were out of work, and so we actually helped 23 different grocery stores with people just to stock shelves, you know, taking bartenders and turn them into grocery store clerks.
Right.
But Q3, like, we did well, had an incredible Q4 in 2020, and ended up wrapping up the year slightly ahead of revenue over 2019. We actually ended up beating year over year.
Wow.
5%. I mean, it wasn't our normal 500x
that
we were doing, but yeah, 5% above. And we improved the company. Like, everyone doubled down, and we improved the product. We improve our processes, we improve our operations.
You became leaner as a result of just more efficiency that you had to do because of running out of money.
And it became, the talent density was at all-time high, right? You have to only keep the rock stars. And
right.
Turns out you can do a whole lot when you've got a team exclusive of rock stars.
That's so fascinating. So you view it as you came out of COVID in 2020 a stronger company than even going into COVID.
Absolutely.
And you almost had to shut down because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Like, were there times when, you're like, okay, we might have to, like, pull the trigger and, like, liquidate type of thing, or?
Before we raised the capital.
Yeah.
Yeah. We only had a couple months of runway. And if we didn't raise, I mean,
did you have any sort of banking relationships that were like helping you, or were they hurting you as a result of?
No one wanted to lend us money.
So they're just piling on top of the.
Yeah, well, actually, we ran into a covenant situation because we had $1 million line with SVB that we had drawn, and it was based upon hitting revenue based upon our board-approved plan. So we had to hit 85% of our board-approved plan each month, otherwise we broke that covenant and they could take $1 million back. And if that happened, like, our company would have just dissolved immediately because we had was like $1 million in the bank.
and they tried to take the money back, or like,
no, they worked with us, and they we ended up converting it over to a different covenant that wasn't based upon plan, because they said you're just not going to hit your revenue. So
right.
Once we raised the cash, they changed the covenant and said we have to keep more money in our bank than what we owed them.
How is that a good covenant? Like, that just seems like, why would I need the loan for?
I agree. But it meant that we weren't busting it because we weren't meeting our revenue threshold. So it allowed us to keep the cash in hand.
It's like, if you don't need a loan, I am happy to give you one. But if you need a loan,
right,
fuck you, right? Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, it wasn't the most helpful.
That's crazy. All right, so then you come out of 2020. December, I presume, is a good year that or a good month, rather, that allowed you guys. So, like, fast forward to 2021, you've had a great 2021. Talk a little bit about that, and I want to know what's happening now.
Yeah, just as fast as our revenue like turned off, it turned back on, and it was February 6th this year. All of a sudden, like, things got crazy.
And why February 6th in particular?
I don't know.
Okay.
Like just that day, all of a sudden, just tons of shifts started coming in. And just, we just saw this huge inflection point. And more than doubled. We did 115% month over month growth January to February.
Wow.
And then February to March, another 76% month over month growth.
That is incredible.
And it looks like we'll probably double March and April. So it's... I mean, we're now doing way more revenue than we ever did pre-COVID. Like I said, we did about $600,000 in February of 2020, and last month we did $1.1 million.
Nice. Congratulations. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So in March you did $1.1 million, and it looks like you might double that in April.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
What a great comeback, right? Like.
It feels great.
And COVID is not over yet. Like, so like you might actually, the growth road is huge in terms of now you're a stronger company. COVID is still affecting the businesses, the types of businesses that you serve.
Yeah.
And you're double the size in terms of revenue that you were before as a leaner, more profitable company.
Exactly. Yeah, only 41%.
Can I invest now, by the way?
We're in the middle of a Series A right now. So this is the time now is when to raise money when you go in through that type of growth. But that amount of growth also costs a lot of capital. So we're spending a lot of money to capture all that revenue as well. And, so one of the things that is driving that is so about 70% of our clients pay with credit cards. But about 70% of our revenue actually comes from net term clients, our big, massive clients that demand net terms. So when you grow 100% month over month, your AR, your accounts receivable, is actually building up, and you're not actually able to repay all of the prior month, to fuel the next month. And so, that's why we're raising right now.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you said that the types of customers that you have shifted from pre-COVID to post-COVID. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So before COVID, we really focused on what we saw as the biggest opportunity of big hotels, big catering companies, big event venues, businesses that could order 100 or 200 people from us in a single day. We didn't really focus a lot on restaurants. We had restaurants that were using us. But maybe they might order a couple people from us a day. Our cost of acquisition for those, for any business, we had mostly an outside sales model, so more of a B2B relationship sale. That just didn't scale down to restaurants as well as what we thought would be worth the revenue opportunity. But catering companies and hotels and event venues just weren't coming back very fast. And we saw restaurants starting to open back up and doing takeout and things. And so we saw a big opportunity there and said, hey, like, we've got nothing to lose. We might as well go try to sell someone. And so we started selling to restaurants. And restaurants made up like 5% of our revenue pre-COVID, and they're now like 32% of our revenue.
Oh, wow.
They're signing up really fast, and it's not actually costing us a lot to get them on the platform. And it turns out they're posting a whole lot more than what we thought they would. We're now seeing restaurants that are using us every single day and have completely said, we don't want to hire dishwashers anymore. And every night we'll send 5 dishwashers to a restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And it's just consistent revenue for us now.
That's incredible. Like, what's the advantage for restaurants to do that as opposed to have their own employees?
A couple things. One is the average lifetime of a dishwasher at a restaurant is about 3 to 4 months. It's a turnstile.
So it's a high turnover anyway.
Very high turnover.
And they have to figure out the staffing, and figuring that out is probably lower or about the same cost as going through quick.
Exactly, yeah. It's actually, when you consider the cost of recruitment and, you know, going through and interviewing people, extending offers, training them, and then the cost of turnover, you're over the cost of quick. And right. then you're also dealing with the daily just brain damage of scheduling. And then every single day you've got someone that's calling out sick. And so it means like, I'm not coming to work today, or you just don't show up to work. And then they're like, oh, I got to call someone else. Who's available now? And you're just dealing with this constant battle every single day of who's going to show up? Who do I have to call to back that person up? With quick, it's just put five people that I need at 6 o'clock and people show up.
Right.
And I don't worry about it.
So with quick, do a quick explanation of like, you have the full-time staff. How many people do you have that work at quick?
We have 34 today.
34. And then you have your contractors who are the ones who are actually filling these shifts of restaurants or whatever. How many of those, you mentioned a number like 100,000 in
just
your system?
100,000.
That's
an
insane number of people, by the way. It's just like, how many shifts are you filling on a daily basis now?
500, 600 a day.
Out of that pool of 100,000, 500, 600 people. So what are your thoughts in terms of like labor? I mean, I'm sure, you know, when we see Uber being criticized that they're, you know, employees shouldn't be dealt with as contractors and they should be treated as full-time employees with benefits or whatever. I'm sure you have like very strong thoughts about that and like how it affects that 100,000, right? Like, and, yeah. and how it would potentially affect your business. What are your thoughts around that?
I think if you look at the core reason of why an Uber driver wants to be an employee, it's because they're working a lot of hours using their own car, adding mileage, costing gas, and picking up a trip here and there. And when you kind of net all that out, they're making less than minimum wage. Mm. On our platform, people are making $3 to $4 above what they would normally make in the industry. All of our shifts are paying well above minimum wage. So they're also guaranteed to make the money the entire time they're on the shift, where if you're doing an Uber drive, you know, like you have downtime in between rides.
Right.
I'm going to go accept an 8-hour shift and I'm going to make money every single hour, every single minute that I'm working. And I'm making more than if I was working as a dishwasher or a line cook
at that same restaurant.
Exactly. and I get the ability to pick my schedule. I work whenever I want, only work when I want, only work at the places I want. And I get paid 30 minutes after I clock out. So
really, you pay them immediately?
Immediately.
How do you do that?
Through Stripe. Okay. So Stripe is our payment processor. So that's how we charge the businesses, but it's also how we pay them. So we can pay someone like almost instantly when you load money onto a debit card. So you just use your bank debit card and we can send you money and...
Stripe facilitates this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't realize that they did that.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty
cool. They have
cool.
a whole marketplace model that will allow you to take the money from one side of the marketplace and give it to the other side of the marketplace.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's got to be a huge selling point for the gig economy, if you will, that you're getting paid so quickly.
Absolutely. And the demographic, our professionals, a lot of them are living less than paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
So if you have an option of actually getting paid within 30 minutes, that's the difference between like paying your rent or paying your car. We had a professional, his name's Everson Turner. He texts us the picture of his three little girls one day and said, "Thank you for the shift on quick today. I didn't know how I was going to feed these girls. I was able to stop at a store and buy some bread and meat and put dinner on the table tonight because of you guys, and I'm grateful for what you guys do for me." And that just gives me chills, right? It's just like we're actually helping people like feed their kids or pay their rent or keep the lights on. And it's a big part of what drives us. But when you think of that value proposition, when these professionals, you know, can only get 30 hours a week from a full-time, you know, gig because those companies don't want to pay for benefits, and you can come over to quick and you can get paid within 30 minutes. You can work as much as you want, whenever you want. Oh, and by the way, we also offer benefits to our professionals. So you can have health insurance and the freedom and the flexibility.
Really?
And get paid and you're making more. Like, it's a great value proposition.
Did you hear that, Adrian? I might have to apply for some quick shifts over here.
That's I've already awesome. Signed up.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And right now, like, the...
Health insurance is a pretty big deal. I don't have, you know, like, I don't, as an unemployed person now, like, health insurance is not easy to get.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. But that is so awesome. And that story in particular, just you don't think about it as someone who doesn't necessarily live paycheck to paycheck, that like having a pay period that's every 2 weeks, arbitrarily, it's every 2 weeks. And by the way, many companies pay for 2 weeks prior, two weeks later, right? Like it's just like almost a month of delay in getting paid. And that month or even 2 weeks can make the difference between whether or not someone's putting food on the table. That's insane.
And that's where like so many people use payday loans, right?
Right. And then they lose 20% of their pay because of payday loans or whatever.
Exactly.
Which is this predatory practice of lending.
Right.
Which like it annoys the hell out of me, but that's a whole different story. That's incredible. What a great story, by the way. And you know, like, congratulations on all the success. Everyone, you know, we have met for, we've known each other for a couple of years. And every time I tried to, like, write you a check, I asked a couple questions. And by the time the answers came back, you're like, oh, the round filled up. So I'm sorry. So I'm not an investor. But I love seeing this type of success. It's awesome for Arizona. It's awesome for the ecosystem. You've been a generous founder to other founders in Arizona, and I know you're part of like Startup AZ Collective. Let's talk a little bit about Arizona and what excites you about the sort of like different companies and founders that's happening here. Like, what are some of the exciting companies that you see around you?
There's a lot of really exciting companies, and I think in you know the 4 years I've been here, I've seen it seems like the flywheel's starting to even turn faster and faster, and I think we've got to give back to those companies with our time. You know, the people that have you know been able to go from A to B to B to C, in their journeys, we've got to help everyone else get in that same category. And I think that's one of the things I've really been attracted to here in the Arizona ecosystem is how willing people are to just give their time and genuinely want to help you.
Right.
And like, I've just embraced what I've seen other people doing. I've met with, you know, other founders like Greg Scoresby or Clayton Mask, and they're willing just to take time, not with anything in return, right? They're just willing to help me be successful and make another successful startup. And so that's why I love like Startup AZ and my particular cohort, some great companies that are in there as well. And it's why I've donated 1% of my equity to give back into Startup AZ to help fund the next companies that you know are coming up and those next successful startups that we can take to that next level. But I'm an investor in a few companies, but excited about just the ecosystem in general.
Awesome. Are there any companies or founders you want to name that like excite you the most of what's happening?
Another marketplace company that I'm really excited about right now is Design Pickle.
Okay.
So I think what they're doing with graphic design is awesome. So you can have a graphic designer on staff, basically working in the background and to get all those design requests that come up like all the time. You never have enough design resources as a company.
Right.
So
So does Design Pickle connect you with just a designer that could be anywhere or?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not their own designer necessarily?
It's a fractional designer.
Okay.
So
that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Really cool. Really cool. And you can pay for their pro plan and actually have a designer that is on your Slack. You know, so they're in Slack. You can send them messages, unlimited request, and they work on whatever you send over to them. So really excited about them. I think Postscript, another company that I'm really excited about, they're doing, it's basically a Shopify plugin and allows you to do text message marketing to your Shopify customers.
They just raised a bunch of money too, right?
Like they did.
If I'm not mistaken. All right.
I think 30 million.
$30 million. Are you going to beat that with Quick in this next round?
We'll be right around there.
Is this Series B for a quick?
It's technically our Series A. We had a pre-seed, a seed, and then
So this is the first COVID like round. Sort of like VC type of round. That's why it's technically a Series A.
Our seed round was VC led.
Okay.
But our that seed round was $3.5 million. It wasn't at the threshold I wanted to call it an A.
Okay, gotcha.
So I really wanted our A to be more than $10 million, so we called it a seed.
Gotcha.
And then we had our COVID round.
So. Gotcha.
So this one will actually be our A, and we're raising $30 million in the A.
Okay.
So
that's awesome. I can't wait to put out the news about that, which you have to like make sure that we're synced up for AZ Tech Beat covering that news.
So, yes,
yeah,
we'll do.
Adrian, write that down. What are your thoughts on vaccine rollout, COVID, now that, you know, like, is that sort of, first of all, you mentioned the February 6th time when, like, things really changed all of a sudden. Was that a result of vaccination sort of hitting a particular milestone, do you think? And was vaccinations what's sort of leading us out of this thing?
Absolutely. I think we've reached this inflection point, even, you know, as you see just how restaurants are out there. And, I know how I felt when I got vaccinated, and it's like, wow, all of a sudden I've got this newfound liberty to go out and do things and this pent up like desire to do them. Right. Like,
right.
So I think people are just now getting out there, and they're finding that they want to go back out and go to dinner, and they want to hold these different private parties again. And, you know, it's mostly smaller type events still, but you're going out and doing those things a whole lot more than you have over the last year. And many times more than what I did in 2019, because I haven't done it for a year. So I think that's, you know, kind of why we saw the Roaring Twenties, right? And I think that's what we're going to see here is like the Roaring Twenties 2.0 coming out of the Spanish flu. Like, everyone went out and did a bunch of stuff. And I think we're going to see the same thing coming out of COVID is, we're going to see just a ton of demand for people wanting to get together. We're social creatures.
Right.
And we're also going to see all of those weddings that got postponed, you know, over the last year. Those are all being rescheduled for the end of this year and into next year. And
right.
So I think that's what was happening is, you know, in February. The other thing that about the vaccines is I'm like so impressed with how Arizona has handled this.
Yeah.
And Quick's actually been a big part of this as well. So we're actually staffing a lot of the vaccine sites as well. I love that our Quick professionals are able to pick up some extra money and work these sites and help end the pandemic. And it's been just, I think, a great opportunity to take a platform where you've got a lot of people that are ready to work and get them to go and do something. And it wasn't part of it's not our core focus, right?
Right.
But if we can use our platform for good and like help end the pandemic and like get Arizona vaccinated, like sign us up. We'll do anything we need to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do think that Arizona has done a great job of vaccination and just handling the pandemic in general. It seemed like there were periods of like, you know, where Arizona went through what seemed like worse than other states, but then other states became worse than Arizona. Like, it was just sort of like a bunch of randomness. But in terms of the rules and laws that were put in place, they were not sort of draconian the way like California seemed to handle some things. And they were balanced, I feel like, between something that was sensible and, you know, like accepting the science, but also not going overboard with respect to restrictions, which was nice to see, and embracing vaccinations wholeheartedly. I think we've had over 4 million doses now that have gone out, which is pretty incredible.
Right.
We have a total population of 7 million. And the other thing is that the first shot of Pfizer is almost as effective as Johnson & Johnson was, for example, which is a single shot vaccine. I don't understand why they didn't just say, you know what, Pfizer, even if you get the single shot, you're considered vaccinated.
Yeah. I always wondered that as well, as why, like, why not go give the first shot to everybody?
Everyone, yeah.
And then go give the second shot to everyone.
Right.
If you still need the second shot, right?
Right.
Like, you might reach herd immunity just with the first shot, but it's the same shot. you're just getting two doses of it. Like, spread that vaccine out across more people.
That seemed like at the national level we made a mistake with respect to, you know, how we decided to handle that. But
I also really like how Indonesia handled the vaccine, and they actually took a different approach and didn't choose to vaccinate the elderly first. They chose to vaccinate the working population first and quarantine the elderly.
Oh, interesting.
To get the economy back. Like, the elderly are probably more naturally more shelter in place anyway. They're staying home. But if you want to get the economy going, get the people that are actually out there working vaccinated to make that safe, and say, all right, if you're high risk, you quarantine. If you're not high risk, get vaccinated, get back to work.
Right. That seems so anti-intuitive, though, because like it may statistically work, but like just the non-intuitive part of it is that, you know, something like over 80 were 100 times more likely to die from COVID versus, you know, like somebody who's like 40 or 30, which that disparity seems like, okay, well, let's get the over 80 vaccinated ASAP. You're also a pilot.
Yes.
So how did that come about? I'm a pilot too, by the way.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I got my pilot's license in 2007.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And then I bought a Cirrus. So rather than making this about me, though, but I want to hear about your story of how did you become a pilot?
So I wanted to be a pilot as a kid. My dad was in the Air Force. He wasn't a pilot, but he ran our household like a military household. And he said, "No, son, you're not going to the military. You're going to computers." And that's kind of how it worked in my house. You did what dad said. So I wanted to be a Navy pilot, but I went into computers instead. But I always had that longing feeling, and I'd always be looking up at every plane that flew by. When I left corporate America left my career at Willis Towers Watson for 18 years, did a bit of a mini retirement, and I learned how to surf. Got really into paddleboarding when I was in San Diego on the ocean, and I learned how to fly. So I got my pilot's license.
Which is harder, flying or surfing?
Oh, flying for sure. Yeah.
I can't catch the right waves. I just started surfing. But anyway, so what kind of planes do you fly?
So I did most of my training in Cessna 172.
Okay.
Then I really fell in love with the Grumman Tiger. I was flying that on the low wing. And then right before starting Quick, I started my IFR training in a Cirrus SR-22.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah. And do you have your own plane, or do you just rent it whenever you want one?
So this is one of the things I would say probably the only thing I don't like about Arizona is when I was in San Diego, I was part of a flying club called Plus One Flyers. And I never appreciated how great of a flying club that was. They always told me this is the biggest flying club in the United States. But we had 54 planes that were at four different airports. And as a member of the club, you could check any of them out and schedule online and go fly the plane. The flying clubs here are like very, very small. Like they might have three planes.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, the Plus One was $99 initiation fee, $35 a month. And then you just paid by the hour, and it included oil and gas. And a Cessna cost you $90 to $110 an hour.
Okay.
Here, like, you can
join insane.
A $5,000 initiation fee. I'm going to pay $300 a month, and I'm going to pay $150 to $200 an hour
for a Cessna.
An old Cessna.
Yeah.
So I've been
and a Cirrus is like $300 or more an hour.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's nuts. The pricing is crazy.
So I've been threatening my wife that I'm going to buy a plane soon. So we'll we'll see.
That's awesome. Yeah. So in 2007, I got my pilot's license and went and bought a brand new Cirrus SR-22.
Oh, well, nice.
Flew commercially to Minnesota. It was Minnesota, right? Like where they make it. Now I'm sort of having second thoughts as to whether it was Minnesota. I think it was Minnesota. Took a tour of their factory, picked up my plane, and flew it back with an instructor who basically was instructing me on the flight back on how to fly the Cirrus. It was one of the most awesome experiences ever.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was very cool.
We have to go flying sometime.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But I actually gave it up. So in 2010, I was like, okay, I'm done. It's too much maintenance.
Yeah.
Too many flights that you have to do just to keep your license current. And I was like, I'm doing more flights just to like keep things current versus actually going anywhere. That it's just not worth it. And then I just decided that was it.
Yeah, mine is not current right now either, as I had to really focus on quick. But
yeah,
I'm ready. I'm ready to get back up in the air. So I'm gonna get an instructor and get checked out again. And I miss it so much.
Yeah, that's awesome. What do you do for fun?
Hiking, mountain biking, trying out new restaurants.
Good stuff here. What restaurants?
Let's see, Virtue Honest Craft. It's probably my favorite restaurant here. It's in Old Town.
Okay. What kind of food?
I guess I'd call it more like maybe Mediterranean. Mediterranean, maybe Italian. They've got a wide different menu, but the one thing I love there is their grilled octopus. So they actually soak the octopus in this vat of water, but they put all of their wine corks into this water, and I guess the acidity from the wine corks of the wine residue gets into the water and tenderizes the octopus.
Oh, that's
and it comes out with this phenomenal texture. So that's really good. And they also do this massive, looks like a dinosaur cut of meat. You know, it's just this huge steak that they bring out, and so that's great. Ocean 44. I love the seafood there. During COVID, I had planned this big birthday party for my wife, and that didn't happen. But we ended up going out to Binkley's, which was a fantastic dinner. I think it was like 14 courses. And one seating a night at 6:30 every night. And just a phenomenal experience. And the food was just unreal.
What's it called? Binkley's?
Binkley's.
Interesting. Okay.
If you're listening and you own Binkley's, Quick is a great alternative to your current dishwashers, and
that's funny. You don't need that at this point. They're lucky to have Quick than the other way around, right? Like any one particular. Cool. What's going on? What's like going on in life that you're excited about? That what's going on in the news that you want to talk about? Anything?
It's probably, I don't know, 7-10 years ago, I gave up watching the news.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What perfect timing, by the way. You missed out on all of the last 4 years of goodness.
Yeah. I just found that it was mostly negative. And it was just occupying a lot of my brain. And if something's really important going on, like someone's going to tell me about it anyway. And so I still feel somewhat up to date, but not constantly barraged with just the overwhelming negativity of, I think, news today.
Yeah.
Half of it we don't need to know about.
By its nature, news is such that you have to like create conflict when there isn't much. So you have to like cover things from a negative angle, just so that you can get people interested in watching it,
right?
Like, but it's a purely math game in terms of like, if you don't have watchers, you don't have a channel and
that's how they make money, right? Yeah. Is they got to have viewers, they have eyeballs for their marketers and like the commercials that they do. So, so I gave up news. What I am excited about is traveling again.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about traveling again. So
have you gone anywhere?
We just got back from Puerto Vallarta.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, my wife, so we're both on our second marriage. We both had our mulligan marriage, which is actually a book that she's writing right now called The Mulligan Marriage.
That's awesome.
So in her first marriage, she actually moved down to Puerto Vallarta and opened up a bar and restaurant. And so we went down there and saw some of her friends and went on a just amazing taco tour. It's actually her friends own this taco tour, and it's rated the fourth best food tour in the entire world. Sorry, and it was phenomenal.
Really,
so, had just a ton of fun down there. First time on a plane, since COVID started, and just great to get away and unwind a little bit.
That's awesome. And The Mulligan Marriage? That sounds like a pretty cool book. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So she's a writer, I take it.
She's a writer. She's an amazing artist as well. Is actually doing a bunch of commission paintings right now. But yeah, it's you should check out our website. It's themulliganmarriage.com.
Yeah, I will. That's awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for taking the time to come down here, talk about the quick story, and just catching up. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. All right, man.
All right.
Thanks. All right, you made it to the end of the episode. I would love to get your feedback, so take a moment to leave a genuine review in your favorite podcast app. That also helps us reach more people. Speaking of reach, if you like a particular episode, be sure to share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. See you next time.